Welcome back to The Stacks. This week is a book club week, and we're talking about How Democracies Die by Stephen Levitsky and Daniel Ziblatt. I'm your host, Tracy Thomas, and our guest this week is activist and organizer Harris Cohn. I love this show so much, and I'm loving making it with all of you. I'm so excited and grateful for this amazing community that we've built, and I want to give a shout out to those of you who have joined the Stacks Pack through Patreon. It helps to make the show a reality, and I know that I couldn't do it without any of you. Two of our most recent members of the Stacks Pack are Joseph Papa and Lisa Lalik. If you're not familiar with Patreon, it's a platform where our listeners pledge monthly contributions to the show in exchange for perks and inside access, and it connects you with our awesome community of readers. So check it out and join the Stacks Pack at patreon.com/thestacks. We're actually now running a virtual book club for any Patreon member who pledges more than $3 a month. It's really fun, and it's a great way to connect with each other and talk about the books that we're all reading. Check it out at patreon.com/thestacks, and Patreon is spelled patreon.com/thestacks. If you're not able to commit to monthly contributions, you can always do a one-time donation at paypal.me/thestackspod. Our sponsors this week are Audible and My Mentor Book Club. Audible is an online database of audiobooks. They have a huge selection where you can certainly find a book that you like. I actually just went to this awesome event with Kwame Alexander, and I heard him read from his new book, Swing. He narrates the audiobook, and I think that that might have to be my next audiobook listen because he is amazing. Listeners of this show get a free audiobook download and a free 30-day trial, so go to audibletrial.com/thestacks. My Mentor Book Club is a monthly subscription box of two newly released nonfiction books each month. The books are curated and they range from business books to memoirs and a lot more. The books come to you, it's free shipping, and you can cancel at any time. And if you go to mymentorbookclub.com/thestacks, you get 50% off your first month. Here's your weekly reminder to subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And if you're listening to us through Apple Podcasts, please rate and review the show. Our most recent review comes from Tracy Fan. And no, that's not my mom. Well, it might be, but I'm pretty sure it's not. They say, quote, "Refreshing, delightful, insightful for guys and gals who love reading. Tracy is a must. Huzzah." Very short, very sweet. Thank you so much. If you haven't yet, please just take 2 seconds to post a quick review. It helps the show and it helps to grow our community. This week, we're talking about How Democracies Die by Stephen Levitsky and Daniel Ziblatt. Barack Obama included this book on one of his most recent lists of recommendations. We recorded the episode before the list came out, so you'll hear me say, I wish Obama would talk about this book. I'm a little ahead of my time. President Obama says about the book, it's a useful primer on the importance of norms, institutional restraints, and civic participation in maintaining a democracy, and how quickly these things can erode when we're not paying attention. Don't worry, there are no spoilers this week. Enjoy. Okay, we are back this week with our guest Harris Cohn for another episode of the Stacks Book Club. We're discussing How Democracies Die by Stephen Levitsky and Daniel Ziblatt. This book is an examination of the current U.S. political climate and its relationship to other governments that were once democracies that turned to authoritarian governments. It's very smart. It's of this moment. It's very of this moment. What did you think of the book, Harris?
I thought it was ridiculously of the moment. You put it well.
Sure.
And kind of a manual. I thought it was a good, it was literally an instruction manual for what our politicians should be doing.
Right. Well, and also kind of how we got here.
Absolutely.
How it really here. Sets up kind of the scope of the situation in current U.S. politics. I really liked the book. I thought it was really interesting. One of the things that I really appreciated about the book that's something that often irritates me in the way that politicians talk about this country is that our democracy isn't exceptional or unbreakable. And I think sometimes conversations about politics in America, it's all about like we're this shining city on a hill and we're so perfect and whatever we do is the right answer. And I feel like this book was honest about the fact that like this American democracy can break too. Like, you guys aren't special. And also putting it in context that this isn't the first time that America has been in a situation where, you know, our political parties don't agree, or that the first time that there were politicians who have been, you know, attacking democracy.
That idea that we are not as good as maybe the political soundbites make it seem like we are, mm-hmm. specifically every politician, seems like a rite of passage to stand up and say, we are the best country in the world,
right.
blah, blah, blah.
Right.
That idea was burned into me at a young age, mm-hmm. coming from a family that we watched the election night together and whatnot. I relate to that idea. The more that I've seen politics evolve from roughly when I got really into it, 2008 to now, that idea has started to crumble a bit.
Sure.
And this book really brought it crashing down.
Sure.
Did you have that idea growing up as well?
No, I'm a black woman. Like, we, you know, there is a sense of reality about this country if you come from certain groups or backgrounds, or if you've experienced life through certain lenses. Like, I'm sure, you know, transgender people have different feelings about this country than, you know, cisgender people, right? Like, or disabled people, or people who are confronted with the holes in our democracy. So no, I mean, my mom is white, my dad is black, and my dad was a pretty militant guy, and he was always made it very clear, like, you know, the system's a little bit rigged and it's not rigged for you. So I never really felt like, I always knew there were issues.
I think that's one of the most, as a white male, one of the most, like, reading books like this is a sideways approach to realizing that there's so many things wrong
sure.
with how we do things here.
Sure.
And for folks that are, like, again, as maybe just as a white person, for other white people that are seeing this moment and maybe not feeling like they can identify with it because mm-hmm. they haven't lived those traumatic experiences, this book I would highly recommend.
Yeah.
Because it puts it in terms that are less personal, which is not necessarily a good thing, but it's much more approachable.
Sure. And another thing that I really like this is that this book did, that I is so rare in books written by white men, just, you know, not to put you white guys on the spot, but this book really confronts head on the racism in our political system, and it doesn't shy away, and it really gives it the weight that it deserves. We're going to have spoilers on this show, but not really, because you can't really spoil this book that's about American history. It's like, if you haven't read the book, this conversation actually might make you want to read it more. But one of the things that they focus on in the first part of the book kind of takes you up to how we got, or like kind of takes you up through some other democracies that were, you know, became fascist and dictators and Nazis and all that. And then it kind of settles in American history for a little bit. And then it moves forward towards how America got to be so polarized. They call it the unraveling. And then it kind of leaves you with, where do we go from here, or how do we move forward, or what's at stake? And in the section where it talks about American history, one of the things I really appreciate is that they basically make the point that after Reconstruction, when the South decided that they no longer wanted to participate, and the North decided that they didn't care if the South participated, black folks were disenfranchised and they lost the vote, which I'm sure many people know. But this book really drives home the point that the South became a single party region, just Southern Democrats. Black people were not voting, and that strengthened the South as a place that had political clout. And without changing any laws and working within the laws, they disenfranchised black people to allow power for more white people and to push white supremacy. And this book says that, and it uses the word, like, white supremacy, and they really drive it home. And I felt like I really respected that they were willing to do that, because so many other books would wiggle around it.
And it was a great example of the title of the book, How Democracies Die.
Right.
That it's not this catastrophic meteor
right.
striking the U.S. Capitol building and,
right.
and it goes away.
Right.
It's that malintentioned people get inside the system
and work
and start tearing it apart.
Right. Exactly.
So my favorite stat from that time uh-huh. period that's in the book is that black turnout in the South fell from 61% in 1880 to just 2% in 1912.
Yeah.
So that was the era of Jim Crow, where they were putting all these poll taxes and literacy tests and all these things to do whatever they could to stop black people from voting.
Right. And even in the book, they have quotes that are like, this is all legal and we're going to take the vote away. Like, they really make sure that the reader understands that this was intentional and not something that just kind of happened,
right?
Which I appreciate. Because it felt like, I felt like for one of the, I read a lot of nonfiction, and I felt for one of the first times in my reading that I was really seen by the authors that weren't from my perspective. In a, you know, and not, kind of sounds weird because it's not nonfiction and it's not, or it's not fiction and it's not a story, but like that they really acknowledged that this is a thing. And it came from like two Harvard professors. Like, so yeah, they know, you know?
Right. Like the people in the middle of the establishment, if you
right,
will.
Right.
You know, in my last episode,
yes, where you were the star.
When I was lucky enough to be a guest, I said that this book made me exceedingly angry.
Sure. Talk about it.
The idea that that single statistic alone could not set off so many alarm bells.
Sure.
And I guess in 1912, maybe they didn't have, you know, enough, maybe it was hard to understand that number or something like that. But,
well, they knew. They said that that's what they were doing.
They said that that's what they were trying to do. If you fast forward to, I believe it was 2013, mm-hmm. the Supreme Court invalidated something called the Voting Rights Act,
right,
which thousands of people marched for, hundreds of people died for, I think.
Right. They basically said, we had this law in place so that black people could vote, but now that black people can vote, we'll let the states decide what to do. Because, like, black people are voting, it's fine. Which was lovely of them.
Right. All the voting changes mm-hmm. have to be, before 2013, had to be approved by the federal government.
Right.
Which is slightly less racist mm-hmm. than the southern governments, the sure. southern state governments. And the Supreme Court took a scalpel to the Voting Rights Act in this one little section and said, none of your changes have to be approved anymore. You're right. Good. We made it. We're out.
Right. And let's just be clear. It's not just southern states that have racist voting laws.
True.
I think that sometimes we put everything on the South and it's like, yeah, they were overtly racist, but there's also a lot of disenfranchisement that happens in the North and the West and everywhere in between.
So anyways, that was another reason that made me really angry. And they really lay out the evidence in a way that is, I don't know, maybe nonfiction at its finest.
Sure.
Like, this book has a direction to it.
Mm-hmm. Well, kind of. What did you think? Because, so I, at first I was like, oh, this book is going to be like anti-Trump. And obviously, like, these are people who study democracy. Like, they're not super into the idea of democracies falling apart. Like, they are hyper aware of the warning signs. But I felt like they not only eviscerated the GOP, they also took pretty sharp attacks on the Democrats as well. Like, I thought that they were pretty fair given what's going on, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. One of the most interesting themes of the book, there were like two main themes that they basically were shifting into the back half of the book a little bit of mm-hmm. where, if democracy is dying, what are the things that you have to do to revive it?
Mm-hmm.
And the two main themes are one word, which is like a word that I had so much trouble just understanding and identifying mm-hmm. with when they wrote it down, is forbearance.
Mm.
It's like, could you come up with a more
obscure?
Yeah, like, it's like from Shakespeare,
right?
And then the other one is mutual tolerance.
Mm-hmm.
So, starting with mutual tolerance, just does someone you don't agree with politically have the right to exist?
Sure,
that's a pretty simple concept. Let's put that aside. The other one is forbearance, which is that the rules of the game mean that the rules of the game might not all be written down. And if you start operating outside of those unwritten rules, there's a crumbling effect where other people start operating outside, even further outside of those rules.
Sure.
And so I really, really appreciated how they made it clear that both political parties in the United States have bare fault for not exercising forbearance. Sure.
Well, I think also part of it, though, it's not just acting outside of the written rules. It's also that forbearance is allowing people to have the freedom to maybe do things on precedent and not based explicitly on law. So something, for example, like the Supreme Court, there's no law that says that there's 9 justices. We currently have 9 and we've had 9 for a while, but there's no law that says that the current president at any moment could say, I actually only want 7, therefore taking away 2 potential appointees for their successor, right? And so forbearance is saying, I'm just going to roll with these unwritten rules that we have 9, like there's no reason not to. But not practicing forbearance is trying to rig the rules or change the rules or be hyper rigid with the rules, saying, oh, we have, like, we're going to take away the filibuster, right? Like, that was an act that goes against forbearance because it takes away power, and it's something where you're going, well, this is within the rules, I can do it, you know. Another example they used is of the 2-term limit for the president. That didn't become a law, 2 terms, until 1951, which is crazy to me. Like, from George Washington all the way through to FDR, there was no rule that said 2 terms and you're out. So even people that we think of as being like really bad presidents and crazy and egomaniacs, like Andrew Jackson, for example, followed that precedent. Like, that's crazy.
Absolutely. Yeah. The it makes me think a little bit harder about, you know, if you're running a social club, mm-hmm. or if you're trying to get a dinner party together with your friends, like the unwritten rules that govern how you do that.
Sure.
Where you don't show up at the party without food to share.
Right.
And well, like eat everyone else's food.
Right.
You could.
You could.
But
or you could say.
Totally crazy.
Or you could say, oh, well, you didn't tell me to bring wine. Right. Like that would be what the political parties are doing. If I send out an email and I say, okay, Harris, you're bringing dessert and everyone else, and you're bringing salad and you're bringing this and everyone else brings their thing plus a bottle of wine. And you're like, well, you didn't ask me to bring wine, so I didn't think that I needed to. Like that kind of, like, it's actually on you. The rule doesn't say that I have to.
So when you take that analogy and apply it to the political realm, what you're talking about is there are hundreds, literally like 535 of these people, 100 senators. Wait a minute. That's too many. 235 plus 100. 335 people.
There you go.
That try as hard as they can to like read the rules and then try to either follow them so strictly that they screw over the other side or operate outside of them. There are a bunch of people not bringing wine to the dinner party.
Right.
That's ridiculous.
And it didn't used to be like that. So in the book, they talk about how...
And why didn't it used to be like that? Do you remember what the point they make in the book?
Because there were no black people.
Because there were no minorities in
power. There
were
no people that they had to worry about. So they were able to have that mutual toleration for each other because they looked and they saw someone who looked like them and they understood, you're just another white guy like me. You're also a Protestant. Okay, maybe you're Catholic, but like that's fine. Jesus still, right? Like that it was like... We have little differences. Like you believe that we should be taxed 10% and I believe we should be taxed 11.5%, but I can see past that because that's 1.5%. But when the question becomes, you believe that I should have the right to an abortion and you believe that killing babies is murder or whatever, that's a bigger conversation. We're now talking about the rights of women versus the quote unquote murder of unborn children.
Well, I actually think that's a spectacular example because while that issue has been hotly contested and led to the evangelical vote, which is almost entirely white, becoming a real powerful block of voters in this country, there was still mutual tolerance. It's sure. A good segue to their second theme. You know what? You got an evangelical congressman from Georgia,
right,
and a hippie congressman from California. But they're both white, so
right.
It sort of works out.
But when you throw in black welfare moms are having abortions, then all of a sudden.
Or a good example of this is recently the Trump administration and their, I think it was ICE, the Immigration uh-huh. and Customs Enforcement punks, tried to deny a woman seeking asylum, I think an underage woman seeking yeah. asylum, the right to have an abortion.
Yeah, I think wasn't Kavanaugh
because she's
part of that?
Latina. One of my biggest takeaways from this was if you can't sit down at the table across from me and tell me positively that you think I have a right to exist or a right to basic human rights, mm-hmm. then we know who's killing democracy. I'm not trying to
sure.
take sides. But I think that is a great litmus test for all this stuff related to college speech on campus and all these things. I don't know. That seemed like this very simple pillar. Do I have the right to exist? Do my beliefs have the right to exist?
As who? A human or as a straight white guy or as a Jewish person?
I'm saying that the litmus test to accept political disagreement should be that I give the other side the right to exist. So I know as a straight white guy, I have much more privilege than everyone else.
I just wasn't sure who you're asking. Like if you're asking specifically someone who's on the other side, if you, Harris Cohn, do, but you're saying in general, can the two sides sit down and say your views should exist and my views should exist, which
That's
is
right.
for mutual toleration.
That's right.
So let me ask you though, you just brought up the college campus conversations. And if you don't know, we're talking about there's not so much recently because school's been
throwback.
Out, but like earlier this year, which feels like 9 years ago, there were some college campuses that decided to disinvite people from coming to talk on their campus. I think Steve Bannon was part of that. I think one of those Charlottesville. How many different cities can I name before I get there? Charlottesville organizers that were disinvited. I think Kellyanne too. So you're saying that they should have been not disinvited?
No, I'm saying the opposite. Oh. I'm saying that because
they don't believe in other people's right to exist.
They don't. You don't have a stage. You don't have.
I see.
The rules which keep democracy healthy and strong are that you need to be able to tolerate the existence of another person.
Right. So if you don't tolerate the existence of other people, you shouldn't be tolerated.
It's tricky. But it's kind of not that bad.
That's your litmus test.
Yeah.
Okay.
Based on what I read. Yeah, it's the author's fault.
Yeah. Let's blame Steven and Daniel. Idiots, Harvard idiots. Okay. So
by extension, if anyone ever tells you the Charlottesville folks had every right to parade down that street.
Right.
And if you are ever struggling with your like weird uncle or aunt at Thanksgiving with that.
Coming up.
Thank you. Just ask that basic question. Are the things that they're saying giving everyone the right to exist, or especially the people who disagree with them, the right to exist?
Sure.
And if you can't do that, you don't belong in, you don't, your ideas don't belong in America. In a democracy.
I wonder, though, if what you're saying then means that your ideas don't exist because you don't think that those people's ideas should exist. I agree with what you're saying, but I'm not sure that what you're saying validates you.
No, but see, I have... No, fair point. It's a tricky thing.
It's tricky.
Let me try to extend it. I believe that they, as predominantly white people in Appalachia or wherever these viewpoints exist.
Sure.
I think they have a right to be in America. Sure. I think they have a right to breathe and take breaths and that they're not themselves inherently destroying my ability to do anything.
You're saying that they can be in the world, but you think that they have to change their views to be validated at the table, essentially. Open their views. It's hard. I know I'm kind of giving you a hard time I'm not sure if that is like, for me, that doesn't bear for me because I don't know if it's as easy to enforce judiciously.
That's one of my biggest struggles with the book.
Okay.
Forbearance, mutual tolerance.
Sure.
It's very hard to write down enforceable anything with that.
Right. No, it is.
It's a struggle.
I mean, that's how they kind of say like, that's what keeps democracies sustained, which is also to say that democracies are very fragile.
Super fragile.
Because they talk about how other countries have constitutions based on ours, or like word for word ours, with like they change like Venezuela to America.
Which have then fallen apart. So the constitution itself
is not actually as strong as we think that it is, but that these two things, the mutual tolerance and the forbearance, are what are like the glue, but the glue is not like super glue. It's like Elmer's glue is kind of what this book is saying. Team Elmer's again, got it in.
One cool thing about this book, I'm not trying to plug it, but
we are.
I am trying to plug it. We're not getting paid to plug it.
And we didn't get it for free or anything.
I learned more in this book about interesting things that happened around the world over the last 100 years than I can ever remember learning in like a history class.
Totally. Well, I also learned crazy interesting things about America that I'd never learned.
What else?
My thing that I learned that I was like telling everyone about, I was like, do you know how we have superdelegates? Which I thought this part of the book was so interesting. So if you didn't read the book, I'll give you a quick rundown. But if you read the book, I'm not going to waste your time running it down. Basically, before the convention systems were the way that we know them to be now, insiders in politics were the delegates, and they made the decisions on who the political nominees should be. In 1968, after Martin Luther King was assassinated and Bobby Kennedy was assassinated, there were riots at the Chicago convention, and it was a whole nightmare for the Democratic Party. And so everyone, both sides, were like, we should fix this because this is not great. So McGovern and someone else who I can't remember because he wasn't a presidential candidate later on, sat down and they decided, okay, we're going to have delegates who aren't political insiders, and they're going to follow the votes of the people from the primaries. So they did that for a little bit. Coincidentally, McGovern was the next nominee. I don't know how he knew that was going to work out for him. And then a few years later in the 80s, the Democrats were like, we like this system, but we actually want to add back our political insiders because we want to make sure that we have some control over the direction that our party goes in the future. And so superdelegates are political insiders, elected officials, people who are part of the Democratic Party who are given votes as delegates in addition to the people that reflect the voice of the people. The Republicans did not do that. So that's why we have superdelegates on one side and just all regular delegates on the other.
And the principle, one of the really fascinating themes throughout the first part of this book is that populism can be this very weird catalyzing force that can be very destabilizing to a democracy.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the reasons to have superdelegates is that if you have a candidate, and there's lots of examples of these people throughout the years, Joseph McCarthy, who's mm-hmm. a senator from Wisconsin, I think, is a good example. In the 1952, he started talking about how communism was invading America.
Right.
And he caused, he started accusing everyone of being communists, actually mostly Jews.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea of, I'm going to use the word fake news, mm-hmm. but there's this long history, especially in the United States and other places, of people using a populist message saying, we the people need to take right. down the powers right. that be. Sounds very good. Is usually laced with racism, xenophobia, somehow trying to make themselves rich.
Mm-hmm.
Superdelegates are the antidote to that.
Right.
So when a super populist person shows up spouting all this crap, party insiders or the people that have a lot of influence can recognize that and realize that it would be really bad for democracy if this person wins.
Sure.
Because it would make the United States start tearing apart the Constitution and,
right.
and off you go.
Right.
So the Democratic Party.
Yeah.
After the 2016 primary, which was very hotly contested mm-hmm. between Bernie and Hillary, just did away with lots of the influence
they
of
did.
Superdelegates.
Oh, no. It's interesting. I mean, I was not a Bernie supporter, but I know people who were upset because so many of the superdelegates went for Hillary Clinton. But also, if you run on the Democratic ticket and you're not a Democrat, you have to assume people who are in Democrats aren't going to like you.
I think the authors would probably say that exposing political parties to more populist influence, which is essentially what Donald Trump did,
right.
said, screw the system. No, right. these people don't care about you.
Right.
I'm your savior.
Right.
That's how he got elected. And so the Democrats are now exposing themselves to a
that.
Similar type of candidate
right.
who could be very much outside the establishment.
Sure.
One important thought that isn't totally in this book that I feel like needs to be read in parallel.
Okay.
Because one of the very interesting parts of this book is where they start talking about who starts doing away with forbearance mm-hmm. in the American system.
Mm-hmm.
And they trace it back to good old
Newt Gingrich.
Yeah.
Hey-o.
Newt. Shout out to Newt. You should have Newt on the pod. He'd be a great interview.
He's actually really smart. Did you see him on the 13th documentary?
History professor.
He's really yeah. smart. He's an asshole, but he's smart.
So basically, the around the time of, I think in the late 1970s, both parties start breaking the rules or going too strict on the rules to, mm-hmm. to gain political mm-hmm. advantage. And I think around the same time, money in politics becomes a much bigger problem.
Right.
So one thing that this book, I feel like, I bet they didn't have time to address was that the people working in Washington, as much as we love so many of them, have to answer to people that give them a lot of money.
Right.
And it makes all of these concepts trickier.
Sure.
So that's a...
Yeah.
Pod for another day.
I don't really understand campaign finance well enough to speak on it, but I know that, I mean, I understand special interests. I understand the idea that if someone gives you money, then you're beholden to them, right? Like, even on a small scale, like on this show, sometimes I get books for free to discuss. I mean, usually I ask for the book. Like, I don't let publishers tell me what they want me to cover on the show, but sometimes if I have a book that I know I want to cover, I'll ask for it for free. And then when I get it for free, I'm like, oh, I should be nice. But guess what? I'm not like that. Well, I'm still mean.
Picture this way.
Like, but that's just me in a book podcast, not me as the senator of Wisconsin.
Well, so like if I have to show up at work every day and constantly ask my boss for my job every 2 years, mm-hmm. I'm going to damn well do exactly what my boss tells me to do.
Yep.
So that's essentially the system we have now.
Sure.
Where congressmen go out to...
And congresswomen
go out to their funders and say, give me another 2 years. I'm going to advance the priorities that you care about.
Also, 2 years is too short. They have to campaign all the time. Like, they should have four-year terms. It should be rotating.
Or what if one of the most interesting ideas I've read about how to fix campaign finance stuff, which we don't have time to go into, is basically to give every person $100. And that's it. That's all the money that's available to spend on elections. So there's like 330 million people. Let's assume even the kiddies get some.
Sure.
That's like one airplane.
Sure.
It's like it's a couple jet fighters every couple years. So every person gets this money and you have to send it to someone. And if you don't, I don't know, maybe there's a way of distributing it based on
you can't break it up. I couldn't do 50 and 50.
Sure, break it up. Great. So that way there's no one can give money outside of that.
Okay.
So the CEO of Walmart
and
the store manager of Walmart number 6,734 in Green Springs, Oklahoma have the same exact amount of political influence.
Nice. But what about, does that foster rich people to run for office? How are they going to get to different districts?
Look, I mean, there are tons of Western democracies like France, for example. Mm-hmm. They spend 2 months campaigning.
Sure.
That's it. So you don't have to spend that much to win because you're not allowed to.
Right.
So there's lots of reasons. There's lots of cool ways I think we could do this better.
I think so, too. I just think because it's like you put so much pressure on, you give so much influence to rich people or businesses or independently wealthy candidates. Like, you have to be really rich to run for office. Yeah,
throughout this book, and I would, now I'm going to email the authors and see what they say. But as they talk about democracy in America diminishing and crumbling, it seems just that people, the folks in politics are answering to other people. They're answering to the folks.
Not to their constituents.
Not as much to their constituents.
Right.
It's not good.
Right. Ugh, that made me sad. This book is really good, but it does kind of make you sad and angry for sure. Like, it makes you feel, let me speak for myself. It made me feel not only like I was learning a lot, but also frustrated that I was like, I want this book to be in Paul Ryan's hands. Like, I said to someone, I was like, I wish that Barack Obama read this book so that when he did his next book list and he told everybody to go read all these books that he read, that he put this book on the list. Because I feel like people would read it if he said to read it. But I guess every author probably feels that way. Like, I wish Barack Obama would read my book, please.
Well, he hits on this theme of democracy in pretty much everything he talks about.
Mm-hmm.
Both as he was leaving his presidency and now.
Right.
Where it is really up to us to participate more and to actually show up and vote.
Right.
Less than 50% of the people who are able to vote in this country actually vote.
But also, so there's that, and that's true and that's valid, and I feel like that's an easy thing for people to talk about, but I'm cutting you off because I want to make a point that is going to diminish what you're saying, and I don't want you to go too far. I think that in addition to less than 50% of the people voting, which more people should vote, if you're able to vote, you should vote. There's also all this systemic disenfranchisement that's going on that makes it harder for people to vote. Like, for example, if you are a felon or were a convicted felon in certain states, you never get your right to vote back. Even though you have served your time, you were convicted of a crime, you know, do the crime, do the time. Well, you did the time. So now for the rest of your life is ruined and you can't, what do they say? Taxation without representation, right? Like, that's that. Or these voter ID laws that we're seeing put back on the record. Or
simply closing government services that get you registered.
or closing polling locations in certain areas that are predominantly Black or Latino or whatever it is. But also, have you ever read the book The New Jim Crow?
I know about it.
Okay, it's great. Also, if you're not into reading nonfiction,
that's what the 13th documentary is.
You could watch the 13th. So Michelle Alexander, who's the author, she talks about how, and I didn't know this, I didn't realize, like, if you've been convicted of a crime and you've served time or whatever, you can no longer live in government housing. You can also no longer receive government assistance like food stamps. So let's say, Harris, you go and you commit a crime. You get convicted, you go to jail, you serve your time, you leave jail. You don't have any family except for your grandma. Your grandma lives in government housing. Your grandma, if she takes you in, could lose her housing because you're staying in government housing. So even if you got your right to vote back, but you were registered at an address that you weren't supposed to be living in, would you risk your vote to get your grandma thrown out of your house?
No.
Right. So like there's things like that where there are people who are able to vote who don't vote. And, you know, it's oftentimes Black, Latino, immigrant, all these people that are marginalized, and all these people who then become the bad guys. And you hear people being like, well, the Black vote, the Latino vote. It's like, yeah, if it was as easy for Black folks to vote as it is for rich white dudes, I bet more of them would vote. But there's a lot at stake, you know, and I think that like that is equally important and equally a problem, not just that people are apathetic and not showing up, but people are feeling like their lives are at risk. Or let's say, you know, you're a citizen, but your uncle is illegal and you live in Arizona. He's not illegal. Let me say that again. He is an undocumented immigrant because people aren't illegal. I'm sorry. He's an undocumented immigrant, but he's living with you and you live in Arizona and you know ICE is crazy there. Why would you go somewhere where the government can write down your information? Or like, why would you register with the government when you know who's in the White House? So like there's things like that that I feel like there are people who don't vote who can vote who feel intimidated to vote.
Hear all of that, and I completely agree with it. My missive to the 50% of the people that don't exercise the franchise. That's voting, by the way.
Okay, thank you.
Interesting. It's a cool name for it. I have no idea where it comes from. Anyways, the people I'm calling out are white people.
Sure.
The straight up, the soccer moms and that person that sat in front of you at lecture.
Sure.
And your coworker, your like conspiracy theory minded coworker.
The people who there's nothing at stake, right? Like if there's nothing at stake for you to vote or little, right? Like why aren't you just going and doing it? Your job has to give you the time off.
It's a pretty selfish thing.
Right.
It's a pretty selfish thing to not participate.
Right.
And
it's just
but at the same time, for the people that do participate, like myself, I'm calling out myself here. Like I know every single one of those archetypes that I just mentioned who are in my life.
That you haven't called out.
That I haven't, calling out.
Sure, you know, that you haven't been like, come on, Jim, come vote with me today. Let's make sure you register.
That, I think, should be a pretty big wake-up call. And this book does a great job of emphasizing that how precarious of a place we are in.
Right.
And one other thing that it does is it talks about some countries that have gone through an authoritarian regime and then come out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And how that worked and what that looked like.
Right.
It also emphasizes, though, the incredible cost of it.
Sure.
So here's the trade-off you have. Go talk to a person that you know doesn't vote and it doesn't cost them that much to vote and don't bear the risks like you just mentioned.
Right. And they can afford childcare to go vote and all that stuff.
You could go have an awkward conversation with another human being.
Right.
Or you could sit through what could be decades of god-awful human rights violations that either make you feel bad to the pit of your stomach or you're so crazy that you can't see it or something.
Right. Or that affect you and
might actually personally affect you. That childcare that you can afford, you might not be able to afford it anymore because they get deported.
Right.
Like and you lose a cool, interesting person in your kid's
or
life.
Or you're a Jewish person and you're put in a concentration camp. Like this shit could be as minimal or as maximum as you want to take it. Like there are examples that go from censoring the media all the way through to concentration camps in Nazi Germany and Poland. So like while that sounds kind of hyperbolic, it also this book lays out that it could be nothing, but also it could be the worst thing that ever happened to you and your country and your family and your neighbors.
I mean, in the 40s, the United States put tens of thousands of Japanese people in.
I can't believe we fucking did that. Camps. And people in the 50s were like, yeah, no, it was the right thing to do. Like, you
it
know.
Took us a, it took the United States government a long, long time to apologize.
Sure. I mean, but we're. American government has an ego problem and they can't admit that slavery was wrong. People are still trying to talk about how great slavery is and the Confederate flag. It's like, yo.
Speaking of which, if for other resources that do a really interesting job of telling the story of the American South mm-hmm. and specifically black existence in the United mm-hmm. States, I just went to a museum in Montgomery, Alabama.
Brian Stevenson's?
The Legacy Museum. It's Brian Stevenson's.
Did you read his book?
Just Mercy is
I'm gonna
that
cry.
Is the next book that is the book that made me cry the most.
I'm gonna cry right now.
You should have
it.
That question. What book made you cry the most?
Okay, well, you could have answered. You know, don't try to get on me.
The museum is in a former slave warehouse in Montgomery, Alabama, and it is one of the most absolutely moving experiences that I've ever been a part of. Like, I've been to the Holocaust Museum and I've been to the Legacy Museum.
Sure.
There's no other museums worth going to before you go to those.
In America that you know of.
At some point.
I've heard that the new African American History Museum is supposed to be great in DC. Have you done that yet? No, you wouldn't.
I haven't.
It's okay. I haven't either. I haven't been. But Brian Stevenson is my hero. Here's just the last thing, just to try to maybe end on a more positive note. They put out some ideas in the book of like, how do we move on? And one of the things that they say is like, people in political office are going to need to kind of humble themselves a little bit and work with the other side if they want to kind of circumvent having a huge national disaster, you know, because they basically say countries that go away from democracy and then come out of it usually have to hit rock bottom, essentially. Mm-hmm. And so they suggest, you know, if politicians care, they might try to do that work now before the country hits rock bottom. And I'm not a psychic. That's the thing about the book that I didn't love, is that it just feels so current that there's no resolution whatsoever. You're like, oh, this book's already out of date. Like, they don't even know what's going on with this and that, you know, like they don't know about the Mueller investigation really in this book, like, you know. But that being said, they kind of say like there's steps that could be taken, but they've never been taken before a country hit rock bottom. Did you have any ideas of what we could be doing?
On a national level, no. I'm sure there are like thinkers out there who are plotting.
Right. They mentioned some things in here.
One of my most interesting takeaways from reading this book was just how distinct the national political world is from what's going on down your block.
Right. Locally.
The local stuff is like that's at your fingertips.
Sure.
So I felt like it was a great call out almost by not talking about it. Just by reading this book and realizing the national system is very scary, mm-hmm. and very broken, mm-hmm. making my local existence the best it can be.
Sure.
Felt super important.
Right. But also like the thing about that is like, you know, maybe not your local next door, whatever, like block manager or whatever, but a lot of people, even if you're electing the people that you believe in, they are being sworn on as like anti the other side. Like that there's like, I mean, even Eric Holder basically said that if the Democrats win the Senate in 2018, that they should not confirm any Trump people, Supreme Court justice people. And like, while I understand that like want for vengeance because they stole that seat from Merrick Garland like thieves in the night, I also am like, that's not gonna fix anything. Like I listened to him talk about it after I'd finished reading this book and I was like, fuck man, like if you, this judicious person, this attorney general, which, you know, feelings about that job too, think this, someone who deals with the courts regularly, like this is not good.
So do you mean solutions like at that national level?
I don't know. Well, one of the solutions in the book was like the Democratic Party should move more towards universal benefits as opposed to benefits based off need. So as opposed to saying that for low income families, we're going to do food stamps, that they move towards a universal living wage or a higher minimum wage or universal health care, an idea that no candidate ever has ever wanted to give people in America, and definitely not the last president, certainly not Obama. But things like that are everyone benefits from them so that it's more inclusive of people who quote unquote feel like they're being quote unquote left behind because they're quote unquote from a coal mine, which all of that's in quotes because I believe that that is a narrative that we're being sold that isn't true. Something just came out saying that Hillary Clinton's voting base was less wealthy than Trump's, which right?
Makes perfect sense.
Sure, but everyone's talking about how Trump has all these poor white voters. It's like,
you know,
he didn't. But that's the narrative we want to tell ourselves. And I'm sure people in a coal mine somewhere did vote for Donald Trump, but I'm also sure some people in a coal mine voted for Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, I think that is the most, that is absolutely the most like disruptive and interesting part of politics these days, is that the amount of inequality in this country that affects people of all races is, I would argue, is strangling democracy.
Yeah.
And so whoever is able to grasp that and put forth a set of ideas that are not about populism and not about ripping the system down, but by making the system actually
reallocating to serve the people. No,
it's hard. I mean, as I try to say this out loud, it sounds really populist-y,
sure.
And which is like where authoritarians come from.
Well,
but I think that that solution is a really good one, which is that this is not a polarizing thing. This
it's not need-based. Everybody gets it.
I like it.
I mean, I that was the first solution that I'd ever heard that I was like, sure, that makes sense.
Well, and what's exciting about it is that it alters the playing field from like winning and losing one side versus the other side.
Right.
And actually legitimately saying, I don't care who you are, let's lift all the boats up. Let's let's try to float together.
Well, you've heard this about equity and equality. Have you heard about the difference between the two? So a lot of people say like, we want equality, equality, equality. And the conversation that I've heard, the way that I've understood it, I think DeRay McKesson talks about this a lot, is that equality is that everyone gets the same thing.
Everyone ends in the same spot.
No, equality is that everyone gets the same thing. Equity is that everyone gets what they need slash deserve. So if you have a school in a really wealthy public school in a really wealthy area, and they have like this amazing drama program and all of this and that, and they have a gym and whatever, then you have an inner city school that has like nothing, the roof's falling down, they can't drink the water. Equality would say everyone gets $100,000. Equity would say the wealthy school that doesn't need for anything gets $0, and this school gets the 200,000 because we need to lift everyone up to the same level. Now, that goes against what we were saying about the Democrats saying not for need-based, but the idea of equity is that the starting line is moved to the same place, right?
Yeah.
So there's these two different conversations, right? And maybe the equality part, the things that everyone gets the same thing, should come from the government, and the equity part should come from private interests, right? Like maybe that's the way that you separate it, so that that responsibility of deciding who is worthy and who is not placed on the government.
All those ideas were new to me and so interesting. And if everyone went and read this book, if those 50% of the people that don't vote went and read this book and then had that, those ideas, like had it, even a little bit of a thought about it, it would make things in this country a little bit better, I think.
Yeah. Well, that's a nice way to end. I normally ask you what you think about the title of the book, but it seems pretty straightforward. I liked it.
I liked it a lot.
And I love the cover. And I love the inside. The hardback is orange. I don't know. Really, like, I'm into the way the book looks.
It's a good looking book. It has a really in-your-face feel.
Yeah.
What the subject matter
is. And I'll just say this. We are not able to talk about everything in this book, but there's a lot here, a lot more history stuff that we didn't really touch on, and I highly recommend this book. I didn't think it was the greatest book I've ever read, but like for this moment in time, certainly feels important and needed, necessary. I also forgot to shout out to our sponsor Audible for your free audiobook trial and free 30-day trial and free audiobook download. Go to audibletrial.com/thestacks. You don't have to do that, but it's also nice for you guys because you get something free. So if you don't have Audible yet, go do it. It's awesome. It helps the podcast. And this is my very late in episode read.
Better late than never, like Saving Democracy.
That's right. So yeah, I mean, you would recommend the book to the people, obviously.
Absolutely. And you'll get through it really fast.
It's short. It's 300 pages, but only 230 of them are not notes. So unless you read all the notes, it's not that long. Okay. Harris, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me. Love the stacks.
Oh yeah. Thanks. We try here. He's pointing to my bookshelves that are not in this room again, like he did on the first episode. He's such a jerk. All right, guys, thank you so much for listening. We'll be back next week. And until then, I'll see you in the stacks. That does it for us this week here on the stacks. Thank you all so much for listening, and thank you to our guest, Harris Cohn. Don't forget to check out our virtual book club over on Patreon. That's patreon.com/thestacks to join. Thank you to our sponsor, My Mentor Book Club. Go to mymentorbookclub.com/thestacks for 50% off your first box of new nonfiction. Thank you also to Audible. Get your free 30-day trial and free audiobook download by going to audibletrial.com/thestacks. Make sure you're subscribed to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And if you're listening through Apple Podcasts, please take a moment to rate and review the show. Our graphic designer is Robin McCright, and our theme music is from Tagirigis. This show was created and produced by me, Tracy Thomas. I'll see you all in the stacks.